Log Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Karen Rand's show, The Compassionate Capitalist. Thank you. Sorry for getting started just a minute late. I am down in Florida making the rounds, meeting with investors and clients, and out there on the road talking private equity with the people that are looking for the money and the people that are providing the money. And today we have an incredible show lined up. So we are going to interview Paul Thomas. I've known Paul now for, I think, probably about 2 years. And what's most interesting about Paul is that he sits on both sides of the equation. And so this is going to be very interesting because he not only works with investors and makes private equity investments, but he also has been on the other side of out there seeking private equity investment or investment from the individuals and institutions. And Paul began his investment analysis and management career back in 1969. That means he started when he was like 3 years old, I guess. And just one of those whiz kids. He'll probably correct me on that when I bring him on here in just a moment. But he was started as a fundamental researcher and a technical analyst for his father, as an investment advisor and also author with over 50 years of direct experience. He purchased his first stock in IBM, my old alma mater, in 1969, and has traded invested in all public markets over the past 30 years. You know, because I know they say that if you invested in IBM back then, that's probably where he made all his money. You can make some. They've split a few times since then. So he's invested his own money as well as investors' monies in public and private stocks, commodities, real estate, hospitality, new ventures, oil and gas, which is primary bailiwick right now. Alternative energy, which is a hot buzzword that we got going on. Transportation, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, you know, just really across the board. So just, I mean, stay tuned because this is going to be a great interview that we're going to have here. He's written a number of books. One was been a contributor to The Human Psychology of the Stock Market back in 1969, The New Horizons for Investors. It was a publication because it was from 67 to 75. Successful Real Estate Investing in the 1990s and Super Trend for Investors with 1975 to 1980. And now he has written, it's new to the market. And if you're on the website, you think there's a link there that you can go to get it. But he's written a new book called Winning with Private Equity. And, of course, the main thing that we're talking about in this particular segment is, you know, there's nine pitfalls of private equity that he's going to talk about, because really it's why is it good. And we see a huge transition right now and moving into private equity with the volatility of the other asset classes. You know, we see it happening. So it's important to understand, if it's a new, exciting class of stock for an investor to get involved in, what are the potential pitfalls to avoid? So without further ado, I am going to bring on Mr. Paul Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Karen. How are you?
I'm outstanding. So delighted to have you here with us today. Calling in from Texas, I guess. Is that right?
That's right. Abilene, Texas. I'm so glad to be back with you. We appreciate all the exposure you can give us. We appreciate it talking to you every day if we could.
So great. So so good. So let's talk a little bit about your background and kind of what, you know, obviously you've written some of these other books, and you're knee deep in all these sides of making private equity type of investments. What was your motivation to bring this particular book to market now?
Well, basically what has happened over my career over the past 30 years, I actually started my career in when I was 13 years old with my father. I did want to correct you about that.
I was close. I wasn't three. Okay, but 13. All right.
my father was writing the book. At the time, my father was writing a book called Human Psychology in the Stock Market, and he brought me into his office and said, here, read this book, and if you can understand it, then it's well written, and it's a book that anyone could understand, and that's what we need to publish. So he let me help him edit it and help me understand what he was talking about in the book. And he talked about what they call super trends in the marketplace, and that was a big part of that book, and that's kind of the investment tack that we take when we do in private investments, is that we use a big macro view. Like right now, we're heavy into the energy business, and we have been heavy in the energy business for 5 decades, but we're real heavy in it right now because of what the theory they call peak oil. And peak oil is kind of a global phenomenon that's going on right now. We're basically not finding as much fuel or oil as we're using. So the peak oil theory is causing the prices to escalate and remain higher than they were. So we've had a major shift in the market. And that's why we invest in energy, is because it's going to be more expensive in the future than it is today. And we can make money doing that.
Sure, absolutely. That's one of those commodities on the energy side that, you know, given the nature of our consumption as a world, I guess, you know, it's always going to be something that's somewhat scarce. It's a limited supply and therefore a good opportunity to invest in.
That's
right. One of the rules of thumb?
That's exactly right. That's one of the rules of thumb in our private equity investing, and the way we approach it is that there has to be a growing demand, and we have to be in a position of competitive advantage in some way. In our oil and gas fund that we run, we're in the competitive advantage. We own an interest in 300 oil wells throughout the United States, and we continually raise money to buy new oil wells, new interest in oil wells, and we own interest in oil wells in 7 states. So we're very diverse in that fund. And that fund, do you remember what the S&P did last year, Karen?
No, I'm sorry, I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Well, it was down. By my calculation, it was down about 34%. Well, our petroleum growth fund did over 30% last year. So it's very contrarian-type investing. You have to be ready to be a contrarian if you're going to do well in the private equity world. One of the things that we always say in the business, if the bears are running, then wealth is being created. But you have to be a contrarian to do that. You can't run with the pack and make money in the private equity world. You have to step out and manage your own future.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there's a lot of some of the great investment minds throughout history, you know, really have said that. You know, I always look to Robert Kiyosaki as one of those folks that, you know, he's built a phenomenal business just on advising people on what they're supposed to do, and he's one of those. And even Warren Buffett was, you know, you need to look for when everybody's running away. You know, you want to be out of the market when everybody else is getting into the market.
That's right.
You know, that's when you want to be out. You want to be moving the other way, because that's what you saw a lot in this real estate bubble. You always see bubbles, you know, and the ones that made the most money, even like in the .com thing and the real estate bubble, were the ones that led it, saw it as a down market, and got in. And like, that's why right now is a great time, because there's a lot of undervalued assets out there that you can get involved in, and, you know, on the private side. And most regular investors never even realize that there's a private side to making investments. They only know about the public stocks that are out there. So
right.
Why don't we do a investment 101, just take a step back and sort of give your insights, the way you would describe it, on the fundamental difference between a private equity transaction and a public, if you will, equity type of investment.
Well, we consider private equity to be much safer, much safer than any kind of public stocks and public bonds that you can buy. And the reason we do that is because when we're investing in private equity, we have one shot at making the deal work and making it right. So we have to really do our homework. We can't sit at a computer and push a button and get in and push a button and get out. Like whenever we go buy an interest in an oil well, it may take us 6 months to actually get that deal done and get the research done and do all the background checks that we need to do on the history of the production and the history of the area and, you know, everything that you have to know to be able to make money in the private equity world. Is the amount of data and information you need is so much larger than it is in the public stock market. That's the number one thing that helps us make money in the private equity world, is that we know our investments inside and out, and we're managing those investments on a daily basis. So we know what the markets are doing, the markets that we're dealing in are doing. You know, if I buy IBM today, I have no earthly idea what IBM's doing today. I can't keep up with it. There's no way. And there's another pitfall to that is the president or CEO of IBM is making multi-million dollar salaries, and my stockholder earnings are paying those salaries. So that's another thing that's the detrimental thing that we see for investing in the public markets. That's why we invest privately. None of my fund managers make those kind of dollars. They make their money in ownership in the fund. They earn ownership in the fund, and they earn their way into the deal. Like if we're building hotels, you know, if they work for the fund and build hotels for us and manage those hotels, at the end of the deal, they may own 15 or 20% of the business. Well, they're an owner in that business. They're not a stockholder. They're an owner. They're managing the daily business. They know the business inside and out. It's not like they own a piece of stock of IBM or Microsoft or Cargill or some of these companies that you have no earthly idea of what they're doing. And that's in our mind, that's one of the major differences in private equity investing versus public stock investing, is that you actually are on the ground and you know what's going on with your investments. You know what's going on with your companies every day, and you're able to keep up with it, and you have to do exhaustive research before you ever enter the investment. So that's the number one rule that you have to abide by when you're doing private equity investing.
Okay, yeah, and that's one of the things I always tell investors like that are looking at this. So the difference between, and you just said it too, the difference between investing in a public company is that we saw this in all the stuff. A lot of these great companies that really didn't have bad performance got hammered because the hedge funds were dropping they had to get liquidity because they had made an investment on a real estate side that was going under and they needed liquidity. So they drop a good stock. It drives the price down so that individual investor gets hammered in that and has really no control except just to hold on and hope it goes back up. Whereas in the private equity side, typically you're already sort of on the bottom, it's working its way up, or else it's just, you can, like you say, you can get involved, you can influence if you've got industry experts or you got people, you have a say in the matter because you really are much more of an owner in the company, and you at least have some hope of getting, depending on how the terms are structured, of getting, you know, involved to make a return, to get your money back out or at least get a return on it than you really have when it comes to public markets.
That's correct, Karen. It's very, very much of a detrimental thing to an investor, especially to a small investor. One of the premises that I've put forth in my new book is that you have to take control of your financial destiny. And you can't take control of your financial destiny if you're putting your money in a public stock out there and letting somebody else run your money for you as far as understanding what the company's doing or, you know, buying into Global Crossing or, you know, what the problem is that the American investor, and this is notorious, is incredibly impatient. They want their money today. They want their profits today. They want to be able to click a button on the computer and make a profit. Well,
right.
You know, if you're gonna really create wealth, you can't do it like that. I mean,
correct.
And a stockbroker will tell you, yeah, you can do that all day long, and yeah, you can make money doing that. But I'm telling you, from 30 years of experience and trying to do that, and working through that, and working through the public markets, and going to stockholders' meetings, and doing everything that you have to do, like Peter Lynch did when he was running Magellan. You know, when Peter Lynch retired from running Magellan, he basically said,
yeah,
this fund has gotten too large. I can't run it anymore. I can't place the money effectively and make money for my investors, so I'm gonna step out, and Fidelity's going to do something else with this fund. So that's in the private equity world today with the big Carlyle groups and those big private equity funds and the hedge funds. They've basically become a product of their own progress or their own success because they've got billions of dollars that they have to push around. And they try to do it in the public markets, and it causes problems for the small investors. And the small investors lose their shirt. I don't know how many investors. I think Chrysler had well over 500,000 investors, common stockholders in their company. I don't know the number, but it was a large number of common stockholders, and those common stockholders today have no value whatsoever in their stock. So that and it's a tragedy. I mean, these people have their life savings and their retirements all bound up in this stuff, and now they're destitute. I mean, and it's terrible. So private equity, our whole premise is that if you're going to be an investor, you need to make yourself bulletproof. In other words, this is not going to happen to you. And
Go ahead. You're saying a diversification strategy, right? I mean, private equity should become one of the asset classes that they have so that they have a bulletproof diversification strategy in their investment portfolio.
I agree with that, yes. All of our portfolios are highly diversified. Like I said, in our energy portfolio, we own interest in 300 oil wells. That's an extremely diversified product. Somebody buys into that, they instantly own an interest in 300 oil wells. So
and I was talking to somebody about your oil thing. And the name of that company is Oil States Trading, or the name of that offering, is that right?
Yes, Oil States Trading is the name of the general partner, and the fund is called the Petroleum Growth Fund. That's right.
Right. Anybody that's listening that wants more information, particularly about that, they can go to the launchfn.com website, launchfn.com, and click on, there's a brief description under the company portfolios, but you can go to contact us, and we can get you in touch. And then, Paul, you probably have a website that they can go to look at that information about that fund. Do you have a website on that?
Yes, they can search the internet. They can Google us and find us. It's oilstatestrading.com. Yeah.
Yeah.
It
doesn't
talk about the fund. It just talks about our company.
Yeah. Right. Talks about the company. And the thing that I thought was really, because, you know, some people think, you know, where is there new opportunity in oil? And I was explaining that in that particular case, you're looking for, it's great because they're already income producing fields, and you're taking an ownership portion, not complete operation of, just an ownership portion, so your investors play in those revenue streams as they continue to grow over time.
That's correct. That's correct. And we've been oil and gas operators in the past, and we decided to let Exxon and Mobil and Marathon and the guys that do that well do it, and we're going to sit back and be investors with those guys, and that's what this fund does.
Okay. Outstanding.
We buy producing oil wells in that fund. Well, what we've done is structure that fund so any foundation or any type of low-risk type of entity that needs low-risk investment can actually invest their dollars in that and be pretty secure in their investment and feel like it's going to return them a good return on their capital.
Yeah.
We've taken done everything we can do to take the risk out of the oil and gas business for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to the book, okay, and talking on the private equity, because there's so much that I think that information you can share with our listening audience, and of course we'll have this as a replay again. But this is because it's a confusing area. You know, we see based on some trends, you know, the early stage private equity is different than, say, you know, private equity funds, so to speak. But it's important to understand that it's all private. And so sometimes the information is not as readily available as it is, say, in the public market where you can do that point and click kind of a thing. But it's something that people really need to understand, that the sophisticated investors, when it comes to getting involved in this type of asset, whether it's through a fund or somebody who's managing it, or through, you know, individually at their own discretion, that it's just it's something that they need to be more aware of, because our studies have shown that 66% of those that can invest in private equity have an emotional desire to invest in private equity, simply do not, only because they feel they're uncomfortable with the process. They're not familiar with sort of, you know, how to do it, what the outcomes, what should they expect. It's just, you know, there's just not as much information out there as there is for, you know, making real estate investments or public stock investments. So, you know, one of my main goals out of interviewing you with your book and for this particular show was really to help clear the air a little bit about sort of the nature of private equity. So so let's get started, because you've got decades being in this space. So why do you, Paul Thomas, invest in and manage private equity?
Well, I manage private equity for people so that they can be secure in their investments. We whenever you have an illness, an example, whenever you have an illness, you don't go see a veterinarian. You go see a doctor. You go see somebody that's looked at a thousand or a million illnesses in his lifetime and can pinpoint what the problems are with you and your illness. You have arthritis or you have gout or whatever you have. And the doctor can look at it and say, oh, that's that. Here, I can take care of that for you. Well, that's what we do in the private equity world in my practice here in Abilene, Texas, is that we've been in the private equity world for 30 years or longer, actually. And we can look at a deal in a very short period of time and tell you whether, yes, we're interested in that program. Yes, there's promise in that program. We've done research in that program. We know what the pitfalls are in this program. Or we know where we can find somebody who knows this, or we can bring, or we have somebody on staff with us that knows this area. Like we have a man here on staff with us that knows the insurance business inside and out because he ran an insurance company, a large insurance company, for several years. That's an example. So if you bring us a program of insurance of some type, you know, we have somebody on staff that can help us decipher that and work through it and say, okay, here are the pitfalls and here's the good things about this and here are the bad things about this.
So then how do you, because since you are kind of on both sides of the equation, how do you help investors? What is sort of your checklist on looking at private equity and whether it's a good investment or something that you should even spend any more time evaluating? Hello? Did I lose you? Hey, Paul?
Karen, are you there? I guess I got disconnected.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. All of a sudden I asked a question and I wasn't sure if it was my phone, and then I looked at my switchboard and you were
I just got disconnected. Ask your question. Go ahead.
Okay. So my question was, because I heard your answer, so I think it was just my question that your original first answer. So you as a private equity investor, also somebody that works with other investors to put their money to work, how do you help the investors? How do you identify even like a basic, what's the basic sort of needs requirements to even spend more time looking at a private equity opportunity? What's your sort of your litmus test to get through the gate?
Well, for one thing, we have to know something about the marketplace that we're dealing in. We don't deal in technology, so if somebody brings me a software deal, I'm going to say, you know, I really can't help you.
That's not your particular thing.
Yeah, I'm not a software guy. I really know nothing about that marketplace as far as trying to make money in it. We do a little bit of stuff in the pharmaceutical stuff. We do some pharmaceutical research. We've got some people that work with us that are active in that arena, and we do put a little money in that kind of stuff every so often. We don't have any money in there right now, but we like the energy business. We like what. Our private equity practice is core business type things. Core business being scrap metal, being oil and gas and energy and alternative energy and wind and recycling and disaster relief and just hospitality is a core business that we like a lot. Real estate is something that we do a lot of. We actually have 13 different funds and real estate funds in the Houston marketplace right now. And the whole world is dying. They feel like they're dying because the real estate market is so bad. And our little funds, we sold 15 lots last month. You know, we made probably $1 million last month in our real estate funds in Houston. And everybody else in the world's crying because they can't buy a lot or sell their house or whatever. And we're making money, you know. So that's another thing that a private equity deal that we're going to be interested in has to have. It has to be a contrarian type deal that's going to make money regardless of what the economy does, regardless of how much money the government spends, regardless of, you know, what the S&P does or what the NASDAQ does or anything. We don't care about any of that stuff. All we care about is the marketplace that we're dealing in, and is that marketplace stable enough and strong enough to make money day in, day out, you know, week in, week out. At the end of the year, you're going to make a profit, and your investors are going to make a profit. So that's why we deal in the core businesses that we deal in. And if
So your particular type of private equity then are is your investment is a private equity investment that's throwing off cash as it goes along instead of like other private equity, like angel investor private equity that is a wait and hold, typically wait and hold before you get a return.
Right. Our programs have to cash flow. We're cash flow guys. Now, one of the really attractive things about it is that we're going to buy assets and we're going to manage programs that when we sell out, we're going to get a really big payday. But along the line, we're going to make 12, 15, 20% on our money as we go along, and we're going to do well year in and year out, regardless of whether we sell the asset. We're long-term investors. We're in our petroleum growth fund for at least a decade, if not more than that, maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years. I mean, our fund is set up to be a perpetual type instrument that you can pass on to your kids. So, and it's kind of like a public stock in that way, but it's not. It's a private investment. But that's the type of programs. And another special thing about the programs we do in private equity is we don't use debt to speak of. Debt will kill a private equity deal. That's one of the pitfalls that people see. You know, the guys that bought Chrysler, the private equity guys that bought Chrysler a few years ago, man, they are sucking wind today because they used, one thing, they used a lot of debt, and another thing, they got into a business that I think, frankly, they didn't know a whole lot about. I don't know, you know, I don't know them personally, but that was a pretty poor private equity investment in my mind, and it was a huge amount of money, $1 billion. I mean, it's a huge amount of money, and they were kind of a product of their own success. They had $1 billion they needed to invest, and they had a half a billion or a $2 billion credit line, so they used it all up, and they went and bought this mammoth company, and now look what's happened to them. So their investors, that kind of thing won't happen to our investors because we don't use debt. We're cash guys. And I think the private equity world is going to come around to that. I think you're going to see a whole lot less debt. As a matter of fact, I know in the commercial real estate business it's happening now. These people are not able to finance out of their existing debt products they're in. And you're seeing commercial properties come on the marketplace for, you know, 25, 30 cents on the dollar now. And it's going to be a terrible bath for people over the next 2 or 3 years. But it's going to clean out the system, in my mind, and it's going to make it a more secure system going forward, going into the future, where we're not using so much debt and letting the banks come in and take our assets away from us. You know, our investors won't see that. People that invest with us will not see that. So
then what are the key elements of private equity investing process? How long does it take?
Well, it takes that's one of the things about it. Greed is a problem in the private equity world. And if you get involved with a greedy person, you got to get yourself away from them. You got what they're in the deal for is a quick paycheck, and they want to come in and take your money and leave. So in the private equity world, you have to draw the process out. It may take us a year from start to finish to actually get a private equity investment made, and then we're in it for a decade, and then we're probably going to be looking to try to get out of it, maybe. If it's, you know, returning 20-30% on our money every year, we may never want to get out of that. I had a friend from Florida that went to Cincinnati here a while back and bought a gear manufacturing company. He bought a 25% interest. He bought a minority interest in a gear manufacturing company, and the gear manufacturing company owner took that money and doubled his production, and my acquaintance and my friend's income doubled, and his investment paid out in about 2 years, and he still owns that, and that was 25 years ago. So, I mean, if you get into a really good private equity situation, you don't want to get out. You just want the thing. You just want to let the thing cash flow into your account as long as it'll cash flow into your account. So that's the difference between public stocks. In the public stock market, if you're going to make money on a stock, you got to sell it. You got to sell the assets you own to make money. Well, in the private equity world that we work in, and I work in, you don't have to do that. Our deals make money as we go. So that's a primary focus that we have in our practice. It's somewhat different than the other private equity guys. The other private equity guys try to borrow as much money as they can. They use, you know, 5% of their own money, and they use 95% of the bank's money. And we just don't work that way. I mean, that's a very, in our mind, a very insecure way to make a deal and try to make it work. There's no downside to that. If they have any kind of a hiccup in the investment whatsoever, it takes longer or it costs more or whatever, they're upside down and they can't do anything about it. So it's a very treacherous type world. So you have to watch out for that. As a private investor, you have to watch out for that.
Right.
Yeah, if you get offered a deal that has a whole lot of debt associated with it, you need to step back and think about that. You know, do I want to be a part of this deal that's going to have this $5 or $10 million worth of debt associated with it? We had a group of doctors here in our West Texas area that they didn't like the hospital service they were getting, so they built themselves a new hospital. 20 of them went together, and they built themselves a brand new hospital. And about 6 months after the hospital opened, a guy in the hospital died. He was having a minor procedure, and he died. And their government funding got pulled, and the hospitals, they're all now paying off the debt, $10 million
debt
they had. Yeah. So you have to watch out for programs like that. I mean, the guy who's selling it may be the nicest, sweetest, smilingest guy you ever met. But if he's saying, we're going to put up 5% of the money and borrow 95%, you need to step back and say, no, I'm not really interested in that. I'm not interested in being on a note like that. If we can raise
the... Because as an investor, investing in that 5% side, you basically end up being obligated... Or somehow, you know, the deal, you're going to either lose your money or end up having to come up with some other money to basically service that debt.
That's right. That's right. And that's what the doctors here in town that went in with this. This doctor was a very charismatic guy. He's a very nice guy. He's very intelligent. I like him. And he's a great guy. But his deal had some flaws in it. And the fact that he was borrowing 90% of the money was one of the major flaws in the deal. And that's another thing. That's part of the greed situation. That's why I brought greed up when you brought that up, is because, you know, these investors were looking to invest $50,000 and make $5 million out of the deal. that's unreasonable expectation. Very unreasonable expectation. And that's another pitfall of private equity investing is, you know, let me go down the nine pitfalls right quick. And we'll talk about them. I don't know. How much time do we have left, Karen?
We've got, you know, definitely till 1 and, or, you know, another 30 minutes. And then we've got, you know, wiggle time after that, just in case, you know, we're going over. We do have a number of people that have called in on the switchboard, but they haven't pressed the button to raise their hand. So I don't know that they have questions. If anybody has a question for Paul, I think there's a button that you press or one of your key numbers and it'll give me a hand signal if you want to ask a question. So go ahead, Paul, go through your 9 pitfalls.
Okay, well, the 9 number one pitfalls that I outline in this first book, I'm trying to do this book as a series, kind of like the Chicken Soup series for private equity investors. And the number one thing that makes a private equity deal fall apart is greed. And I kind of talked about that earlier. But if you get in bed with, if you get in a deal with a greedy person as an investor, odds are you're going to lose. Odds are that greedy person's he's in the deal to take your money, and you better watch out for it. Greed has been a terrible thing for Wall Street, and the housing crisis has caused all because of the greedy syndrome of people not being able to manage their greed, the streak of greed that they have in them. The number two thing that we see in the private equity world that hurts private deals is too much ambition. And this is kind of a contrary type thing, but if someone comes to you and they're just full of vim and vigor and fire, you need to watch out for those guys, because you've got to do something to test their staying power, because private equity investing is all about staying power. It's all about getting in the investment, sticking with it until it comes to fruition. It may be 2 years, it may be 5 years, it may be 10 years, but if your investment is a good investment, you got to be patient and you got to stick with it, and you got to have the stick-to-itiveness, and the people you're in bed with have to have the stick-to-itiveness to stay with the deal. You don't want them leaving you after a year and leaving you high and dry. I had a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, the other day. He bought a franchise for his child that was graduating from college. The child needed an income, and the guy thought, well, you know, this will be a good income from it. And the young man, the child came to dad and said, Dad, I want to buy this so bad. I love it. I love the business. It's going to make us so much money. And do so. You know how young people are, and they'll talk to you like they're going to be there forever. And then he actually invested $375,000 in this deal, and he bought this franchise. And 90 days later, his son was tending bar down the street. So he had he didn't have any stick-to-itiveness in the program, and that's a very very much of a pitfall in the private equity world. Another pitfall, the third thing that we outline in the book, is ignorance. Ignorance of the marketplace and ignorance of, of the private equity investing and private equity investing as a whole, starting up a new business or buying into a business. Ignorance is the number three thing that's going to lose your money in the program. You either need to be... Go ahead.
So the first one, what was the first one again?
Greed.
Too much... Greed, and then too much
ambition.
That goes too much ambition. That's kind of part of that, and then it's the not staying power, not sticking to it, not staying with it. So it's sort of the patience to a certain degree, not having the patience for the deal to produce its rewards.
That's right. Too much ambition leads to not having patience and not being able to stick with it. That's right.
And then the ignorance of the marketplace.
Ignorance of the marketplace. I know a couple here in town, they took their retirement. They got laid off, and they took their retirement, and they opened up a roasted peanut factory. It's a drive-thru. It's like an A&W root beer type drive-thru or a burger stand. And what they sell
peanuts.
they sell roasted peanuts out of this roasted nuts. Well, you know, in the marketplace that they're in, this deal is never going to make money. I had another friend that invested $100,000 of her retirement and borrowed some money to do it as well. And she opened up a yogurt sweet shop, a drive-through yogurt sweet shop with her retirement money. And she was open about 90 days, and she had to close her doors because she was losing so much money. And that's just kind of an ignorance thing of the marketplace. Not talking to somebody that has experience in the business is part of that ignorance, part of not doing your homework, part of not doing your due diligence, that kind of thing.
Well, Paul, let me interrupt on that point right there, because we see that so often, too, with these companies that come to us, you know, looking for capital, and everything they're doing is based on emotion rather than, you know, the business sense of it. So what you just described is somebody loves roasted peanuts, been to a ball game or something, and decides that they're going to open up a business and say, oh, but, you know, to me, logic would say, you know, you want to figure out how many people are driving down the road wishing they had roasted peanuts, so they're going to go off the road and actually go over there and get it. And is your location something that people are going to actually do that? Why do you think it is? I mean, we want to get back to your 9 points, but have you ever done, because I know you, like, in one of your very early books that you did, it was sort of on the psychology side of things, on what you did, you know, the way you, one of your very first books that you got involved in, Human Psychology of the Stock Market, and I guess that's kind of part of some of the things that people do on it. Why is it that people will make that time, money, everything, their entire place, everything they got, into something based on an emotional feeling rather than looking at it, doing the research, looking at it from a business standpoint of, you know, is this something that could be successful?
That's a human trait, and it goes along with the greed thing. They want the American dream, and they've dreamed about the American dream for 40 years. They worked for 40 years to amass this amount of money, and now they're going to go do the dream. And it's next to impossible to talk somebody out of that unless they can somewhat remove themselves from it. That's what one of the things we specialize in our private equity practice here is that we don't ever fall in love with a deal. We know better than that. You can't be emotionally involved. You can think it's a great idea, but if the research is not there and the numbers are not there to back you up, and the market's not there, you know, we're not a player for that. We're not going to put any money in it. if you can't support it logically and reasonably and show me where the market's actually going to come in and buy your product, you know, we just not, are not interested in that. I spent the last 10 years studying the organic food marketplace, and in 2008 I actually started an organic farm operation to raise organic food to feed the tremendous demand for organic and locally grown food that we have here in our area. So that's an example. You know, we spent 10 years studying this before we decided to drop off and actually put some money in it. But the roasted peanut guy, you know, he's been dreaming about it for 10 years, but he had never done any research into it. And he just leased the space and put his money in, and now he doesn't have the same, you know, I was by there the other day talking to him, and he said, I hadn't had a customer in 3 days. You know,
I had a neighbor, you know, when you said that, I really thought about that. A neighbor of mine, he really knew nothing about, you know, running a business, or like, was from Chicago. You know, I live in Atlanta normally. Was really wondering why they didn't have good hot dogs in Atlanta like he had in Chicago. And so he went, and he did the same thing. I mean, I wasn't involved in what I do now. I was working for IBM at the time, so I never really crossed. I thought, you're going to go open up, I mean, I thought to myself, you're going to go open up a hot dog stand with these variety of hot dogs because they're lacking good hot dogs here? Well, you know, have you really researched it? You know, I mean, I thought about that stuff. I just sort of assumed he had researched it and had done it. Sure enough, 6 months later, he was out of business and lost all the money that he put into it. Let's get back to your fourth. What's your fourth?
The number four pitfall in the private equity world is what I call elevated expectations. I see this all the time in the oil and gas business. I used to deal with investors all the time back in the 80s that we were wildcatters and we'd drill oil wells and you know, they'd put $10,000 in and they expect that $10,000 if we hit the well to be worth $5 million the next day. And that's just real elevated expectations, real unrealistic dreams about what your business can do. My friend that bought the sandwich shop for his kid, if he had actually been the very top sandwich shop in all of Texas, he would have made about a 15% return on his money. You know, so that it just wasn't a realistic expectation for him to think that he could put this $375,000 in the deal and make any kind of realistic return. I mean, even if he was the top pinnacle of the marketplace, he wouldn't make very much money. So that's, you know, that's and like the roasted peanut, let's go back to the roasted peanut guy. You know, if he sold, you know, $500,000 worth of peanuts, his cost and everything would eat him up so bad, he'd only make 20% on his money. So that's not, you know, that's not realistic. It's not realistic of him to think he can sell, you know, $5,000 a day worth of roasted peanuts. elevated expectations is the number four thing that we look for. Number five on the list is what I call overconfidence. And overconfidence is thinking that, this deal's bulletproof, and it's kind of more falling in love with the deal than anything else. But you have overconfidence that, yes, I can run this program, and, yes, I can be at this restaurant every day, or, yes, I can be at this hardware store every day and run the hardware store and be happy and have a happy life and create a life I want to live. And people just don't realize that. They just don't realize that how difficult that is to do and that you have to really, really work at it and know yourself. It's kind of know thyself as an investor. If you're worried about whether you're going to eat tomorrow, you don't need to be trying to invest in private programs somewhere. You know, you need to be more diligent than that. Number six on the list is a problem I call marginal deals, and I kind of alluded to it a minute ago. Let's go back to the sandwich shop. If my friend that had bought the sandwich shop for his child had been the very best sandwich shop of its kind in the entire marketplace, he would have made a 15% return on his money. That's a marginal deal. You know, in our world of private equity, if a deal is not realistically going to make us 20% on our money on an ongoing basis, and then whenever we sell it, it's going to triple or double or triple. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I just clicked a second, but I think we can still hear you.
Yeah.
Let's see, checking the switchboard. You're still there, so we're good.
Okay, that's good. So we're talking about marginal deals. If a deal's going to make 15%, if it's the best, we're not interested in it. You know, we're not a player for that. But if our programs are going to make, you know, they're designed to make 15 or 20% a year, and then when we sell them, they're going to triple or double or triple or quadruple our money. Yeah, we're interested in that. That's the kind of program we deal with. We just got finished with a program, and we're working on another one. In some of the markets here in Texas, you could build mini storages there for a while. There was a time where you could build a mini storage, operate it for 2 or 3 years, and double your money when you sold it. Well, that's the kind of program we like to do. There used to be a niche in the telecom business where you could lay fiber optic cable, and somebody would come along and buy it and double your money on what it cost you to lay it. We do that in the natural gas pipeline business whenever we find the opportunity to. There's other types of businesses where you can do that on a routine basis, and that's kind of some of the things we look for. Number seven is a dramatic thing, I think, and it's called counting on the government.
Yeah, that's a big one nowadays.
Yeah, if you're counting on the government to make your living for you or some kind of government program to make your deal successful, we're not a player for that. We're not even going to be interested in even looking at the investment. If you're thinking that a loophole in the tax laws is going to make you a 20% return on your money, you know, we wouldn't even consider looking at a deal like that, because number one, the government has no conscience. They have no conscience about your money or the money that they're spending today. It's a terrible situation. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but you know, we've got to get into some hard assets with our money today, our investment dollars, or we're going to be sucking wind in the next 10 years because inflation is going to be out of control.
Yeah, they're not investors. They're not business managers. They're government people. So, you know.
That's right. I used to work for EPA, and it astounded me how much money those people wasted, just flat wasted. Just, I mean, millions and millions and billions, actually billions of dollars, and that was back in the 90s, on certain types of cleanups that actually made no practical sense whatsoever. There was a time when the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, was trucking their solid waste, their trash, 90 miles into Mississippi to dispose of it. And the EPA rules were making them do that. And that was a tremendous opportunity for somebody to come in and build a landfill, which the landfill business is a part of the EPA business I was in, and build a landfill and make a lot of money in a hurry, you know, with a $5 or $6 million investment, turn around and, you know, be making $30,000 or $40,000 a day. That's the type of investment that was. And the government really kind of charged or caused that. Number eight on our list is what I call mismanagement. I routinely consult with people that they've got a manager that is either so greedy he'll never be able to make the deal work, or he doesn't. Let me explain it this way. I had an acquaintance that I met from Colorado who was associated with a car dealership in Colorado back in the 90s, and the car dealership was owned by a family, a couple of brothers, and they actually came time for the brothers to retire, and the oldest son was kind of in line to take over the business, but the brothers, the owners wanted out. They wanted their money to put in their retirement. They didn't think that their son could actually run the business. So the son, being in the car business for 2 decades, as a gopher in the car business for his father and his uncle, raised a bunch of money from some people in town, and they invested in that car dealership. And the kid, it turned out that the young person didn't know diddly squat about running the car business. His uncles knew everything there was to know about it, but he didn't know anything about it. So these investors actually lost all their money, and the Ford dealership went away, and the investors lost all their money because this kid had been around the car business for decades, but he didn't know anything about running the car business. So that's mismanagement, and it's the pinnacle of mismanagement. So that's another thing that private equity investors have to watch out for, is somebody that thinks he knows how to run a business, because he turned a wrench at a car dealership for 15 years, and yeah, I can run this dealership better than anybody else. And it's not true. There's no truth in it whatsoever. So that's another thing. Mismanagement, number 8 on the list. And I could go on about number 9 forever, but it's debt. Debt is called the hidden partner. And the last thing that we want in a private equity program is a banker who has a different agenda than we do as far as making money and longevity and staying power. He has a totally different agenda about the investment as a whole, and he has control over your investment. He has the ability to take your newly built hospital away from you. So those are the things that we do. We don't. That's why we don't use debt. We don't want some banker somewhere that has a different agenda being able to take our assets away from us and not have the staying power to stick with us. So we don't use debt. That's the number 9 pitfall in the private equity world. So my recommendation. Let me give you a recommendation.
Okay.
My recommendation about private equity investing today is that if you want to private equity invest on your own dime in your own town, find somebody to invest in, and then get a group of friends together. And the retirement community is full of people that have capital to invest. They're just afraid to invest it. They don't know what to do. They're afraid to step out, and they've got all their living expenses covered. They don't need the money. They've got the extra money to invest. And in my mind, this is the number one thing that's going to help America and even the globe out of the financial crisis, is when these private investors that actually have money to invest, they start loosening up and they start going to their local car dealership and saying, you know, I understand that you're short of capital right now. You know, would you consider selling me and my group of friends 10% of this car dealership, and you keep managing it, and we'll just be your partners. You know, we'll be along there with you, and we'll take our profits out when you take your profits out. And you have to find honest people to do that with. But in my mind, as the money flows out of these retirement accounts and does good things like that, it's going to help the economy. It's going to create jobs. It's going to keep people solvent. It's going to keep businesses going. And I'm talking about any type of business, Karen. I'm talking about somebody that sells nuts and bolts, or somebody the list is long and illustrious of the types of businesses that you can consider investing in as a private investor.
And absolutely. You're so right on that, because, you know, as you were talking about, I would say, you know, two things that you were just saying on the number 9 one on the debt side, and these different funds I've been meeting with down here in Florida. They've been talking about they're seeing these incredible opportunities, not because businesses that really were good, cash flow and doing well, just because they have debt that all of a sudden got called, or they weren't able to manage to because of a change in the market that they didn't anticipate. Now all of a sudden they're upside down, and it's creating incredible opportunities for private equity people to go in and assume, you know, take out some of that debt, and, you know, help them and turn this company around, own a piece of it, and now take a chunk of that revenue. But then also, the reason why I changed the name of this show to Compassionate Capitalist is that I'm right on board with what your recommendation is. We investors have to understand that whether it's a small business or a business that's a thriving business that has potential that's just, you know, a little out of sorts in the way that their balance sheet is set up right now, you know, you can create jobs. You could have direct impact on your local community. You can bring innovation to the market. You can do all these things that is really where the foundation of the economy, you know, gets going and gets its fuel for growing. And that is, we're right on the same page on that. And I'm glad that you said that, because it really is something that, you know, as you want to have a financial return, but you can also feel just great about the fact that you have been. One of the terms I started using is an economic architect. Involved, putting your money to work, and turning around these companies, and being smart about it, doing all the things that you're looking at, making sure the books are right, making sure you got a team of people to help you evaluate the deal, you know, all of those kind of things make sense. You can have a direct impact on your local economy and the economy at large by putting that money to work that way.
That's right. That's right, Karen. And that's the fundamental investing approach that in my world of private equity, that's the approach we take. I get approached every day, not every day, but every week, by companies that have, their bank just pulled their credit line, and they've got sales and they're doing great, but they can't buy the product to make they can't buy the raw materials to make their product because the bank pulled their credit line that they used to buy raw materials. Well, that's a tremendous opportunity for you to step up and say, okay, I'll provide you, help you with your credit line, and I'll buy 25% of your company, or 20% or 10%, whatever the value is. And I see that opportunity all day, every week. And our problem is we just don't have the capital available. Our capital is fully committed.
Yeah.
I've got tremendous opportunities, just like you said. There's people all over the country that are having tremendous opportunities. And there are many, many 50-something-year-old business owners around the country who are suffering through this right now, that the people that live within 10 blocks of them could bail them out if they just would come together and do it.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and it would be a good deal for the guy who owns the business. It would be a good deal for the investors. They would be able to watch their investment grow. It's a tremendous thing when you get in a good private equity deal. It's a tremendous opportunity, and it's a tremendous feeling, like you said, of worth and well-being that you have to say, yeah, I helped create that. I helped create that car dealership that's doing so well now. Yeah, I helped keep them on their feet during the hard times back in the 2000s, you know. And it's just America needs to do that, and I don't know what we can do to help Americans do that, but I'm on board with it. And if anybody comes to me, that's the kind of advice I'm going to give them.
Well, I'm glad, because I'm actually working with a couple of companies right now that aren't your traditional angel investor deals. They're not that, you know, brand new hot little innovation that's going to market and needs some money so they can get to, you know, get the product to market and commercialize and all those kind of things. I mean, we always have those kind of deals that we're working with that we take to our own angel investor groups, the Network of Business Angels and Investors, and the rest of the syndicate that we work with. But we actually have some of those very examples that you're talking about. I'm working with this one company right now that they have one piece of their business is just channeling all the type of wireless accessories. And then they have another piece of their business where they're bringing new innovative products to market. And they got into, and then a whole other one where they're, you know, custom manufacturing wireless various types of products based on specs that somebody gives them. And they've got all this great potential. We're growing at a clip of 20% a year. And then last year in the fourth quarter, they had a long-term contract with a company where they, whenever you get the replacement phone because it's an insurance claim, you know, they provided the batteries and the plugs and all the stuff associated with that. Uh-huh. And the company got bought out. And the company that bought them out shut the contract down. And these guys got stuck with $200,000+ worth of inventory.
Oh.
And, you know, and that was really only good for that particular type of contract. A portion of it could be used elsewhere. And it turned them upside down.
Yeah.
And so now they're in a situation where they don't have that much debt compared to the type of revenue that they were doing, but it's just enough that it's making it where they can't go get the correct inventory to fulfill. So they're in this sort of, you know, quicksand situation where they've got orders coming in and turning away $20,000, $30,000 of business a month because they don't have the right inventory.
Yeah,
and that's just, you know, that's just crazy because they have so much potential. But I said, you know what, you know, your regular traditional angel investor is not going to, you know, really see that as that potential because they're looking for that, you know, hot new software product or something, right? This is something that somebody that really understands meat and potatoes types of business, you know, we call it the beanie weenie business, right? It's just meat and potatoes. It's manufactured. It's selling. It's distributed. It's collect the money, and you know, roll with it. You know, to come in and do like you say and, you know, get a piece of this business and it'll be cash flow positive within 90 days of getting this thing together. They can start getting a return on their investment,
you know? That's right. And that's how we work our funds, our petroleum growth funds that way. If you put money in our fund, it's going to be cash flow positive to you in 90 to 120 days, you know. So that's
okay,
the way it works.
So that's terrific. So I mean, I've just enjoyed this so much. I'm gonna in everything that you said is so right on with the same advice that we give. If anybody, we have a number of people that are on the switchboard now. If any of them want to ask a question, then I think if you press 1, when you came in and you raised your hand, like we did that little electronic raise your hand, did you press 1 when you dialed
yes.
in, Paul?
Yes.
Yeah, so they can just press 1, it'll raise your hand. I won't go, I've done this before where I go through and I ask them and they hang up because they don't really want, they're just listening because they're not in front of a computer and I don't want to put them on the spot. So if you have a question, we'd be happy to do that and take your question on that. Let's go, so while we're waiting to see if anybody changes that, let's, you know, there's a whole, you know, a lot of concern out there, particularly when it comes to funds. We've been talking about a direct investment in a company and you know, to sort of recap for the listeners, you know, really you have to make sure you assess their book, you know, get some expertise and other opinions on it, you know, meet with the people. I think you had in one of your pieces, sort of like an outline, is that you want to do background checks. You want to approach it very much like an audit where, you know, you're researching the topic, make sure you're comfortable with the business itself, how, you know, are you comfortable with the people, you know, make sure you've got written agreements on it, you've got, you know, insight and truly set the expectation on how communication after the investment is going to go. So that's a direct investment. When it comes time to when somebody's investing in a fund, and with all the stuff that we've seen here with some of these, the Matloff in particular, you know, any of these kind of things, and I've heard all kinds of stories from other people where they invested in a fund and then it, you know, what's a way that somebody looking at investing in a private equity fund or an angel fund, because we're in the midst right now of pursuing launching our own angel fund, what's something that they can do, what would be a red flag to detect fraud within a fund that they might participate in that they can use as a way to avoid doing that or even when they're, you know, you got any insights on that?
Yes, I do. You have to watch out for things like inconsistencies in their books. Sometimes the funds are a startup fund. Then you have to do the background checks, like you said. I have people do background checks on me all the time, and that's just part of the business. It's part of the world, part of the private equity world. They'll run a criminal background check on you, see if you've ever been in fraud, you know, any kind of fraudulent situations or ever declared bankruptcy. They'll run your credit. You know, I had a fund manager come down and he wanted to invest with us, and he actually wound up investing with us, and he did a 3-month background check on us. It probably cost him $15,000 to do this background check, and they looked at us for 90 days, and they came back and we were clean, and the guy finally wound up investing with us, which is great, but that's just part of the business. That's just part of, you got to be prepared as an investor to pay the money, to do the homework, to get the thing done, to get you comfortable enough that that you're comfortable putting your money out. You're comfortable writing the check. And it may cost you $15,000. It may cost you $5,000. You know, it all depends on the size of the deal and what the gauge of the investment is. I had a lady come. I was at a conference the other day in Tampa, in St. Petersburg, and at a financial planners conference, and one of the planners walked up to me and she said, "How do I know all your oil wells that you own interest in all these oil wells?" This is like 3 or 4 days after Madoff broke and the news was out about him, and I said, "Well, you know, if you would do the homework on our oil and gas fund, you can call every county clerk in the country where we own an interest, and you can verify that we own that interest and that it's in the name of our fund, and you can do the homework on us and you can verify that." So those are the types of things that you might even eventually have to go do to satisfy yourself that, yeah, these guys are legit. Yes, they're honest. Yes, they're writing the checks every month and doing the deal every month and making the right decisions and taking care of my interests and taking care of their investors. There are hundreds of fund managers out there that you never hear anything about. You don't know anything about them. They never hit the news, you know, but they're out there and they're running money and they're doing the job every day, and their books are audited every year, and they're by big auditing firms, and you know, not your neighborhood auditor and you know, that kind of thing. You know, you got to look at Madoff. It's an interesting thing. Pardon me, Madoff. You know, he was a high level security kind of guy. I would have invested with this guy. You know, and I'm no dummy, but I would have invested with Madoff because of his credentials. I mean, these people.
Yeah.
These people that invested with him were not fools.
Right.
People think that they got taken, and they really did. But that was the greed. That was the greed situation taken over. Madoff got basically, in my mind, I don't know exactly all the details of it, but he got caught up in a thing promising his investors certain returns, and when he couldn't make those returns, he had to do something else to make those returns to his investors.
There's a great article, and I think it was, I kept it, so I think it was in, it wasn't The Economist. It was one of those kind of magazines where it kind of went through the whole history of how he got started and how everything about it. And, you know, he started his brokerage firm the day after he, like 2 days after he got married with $700. It was like all the money that they had, you know, and kind of how he got started. And it was really a real rags to riches kind of thing. And I think it's exactly what you said. He had made his commitment, was kind of on the hook. He had a regular, traditional, regulated type of business. And this other thing was kind of in another room, in another floor. And so it was just one of those things. It's tragic because, like you say, a lot of smart people, you know, a lot of people invested with him, a lot of funds, a lot of people that do all that kind of due diligence. But now, when it comes to due diligence, and you, like you mentioned, all your oil wealth, do you provide as part of, like, a packet to your potential investors? So, like, here's a list of 300 counties that you can call and give them that stuff, or do you know, so you make it easy for them
Yes, I make it extremely easy for them. Our transparency policy in our practice here is that any investor that invests in any of our programs can come to our office and meet with us with 24-hour notice. All they have to do is just make an appointment and come see us. They can send their auditors in. They have to pay for them, but they can send their auditors in if they want to do that. If they want to do due diligence on us, they can look at our financials. All of our financials are audited by a large regional firm here that has 60 CPAs on staff. It's a big firm. They have big, you know, big. They do peer reviews. We make it as easy as humanly possible. If somebody wants to check us out, they can check us out. And one of the reasons we're able to do that is that our deals that we do are not rocket science. We don't have any proprietary data or proprietary information in any of our core business. You know, the stuff we make our investment decisions on is research that we've done. And, you know, if you want to invest in one of our WIN programs, all the information is on the Internet. I mean, you can go get the information yourself if you want to. You can dig it up. We use basically a mosaic theory where we take information from lots of different segments and we put it together into a roadmap to success, what we call a roadmap for success for a deal. And these are the steps that we have to go through to make a deal successful. And in our petroleum fund, we've done that. And basically in our, like if we were going to put together a scrap metal program, which we've done some in the past, we would outline in the plan of the program that we would actually, these are the steps that we need to take, and this is when we're going to take them and how we're going to take them. And we make it as easy as humanly possible for somebody to check us out. If they want to run background checks on us, it's fine. We have no problems with that whatsoever. You know, we keep our nose clean. And I'm not the only person in the world that does this type of thing. There are lots of people like me, lots of private equity managers around the country that don't make exorbitant fees on their funds, but they manage good, solid programs. They're real estate programs. There's, you know, of course, there's a lot of shysters out there. You got to figure out what's what. But you do that with the background checks. And our list of 300 oil and gas leases, for instance, you can actually call the county. You'd have to call and get the phone number for the county clerk and call the clerk and say, is this fund registered in, you know, got any kind of holdings in your county, and would you give me the information on that? And they'll put, for a fee, they'll give you the information, and you can satisfy yourself that, yeah, this fund does own these interests. And it's not like Madoff that he wouldn't talk to you. You know, if you called him, you couldn't get a hold of him for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, you call one of our principals, he's going to call you back either that day or just as soon as he gets back in the office, he's going to call you. If he's on vacation, somebody else is going to call you. You know, it's kind of a different mindset in the world. We have no secrets in our private equity practice. We have no secrets whatsoever. If somebody wants to work as hard as we work, they can do the things we do, and sometimes we'll help them do the things we do. You know, it's not like we're trying to hide what we're doing. If we want to go build a mini storage facility, I mean, that's no secret. Everybody in the world's going to know it. It's not a secret. But we'll go build that facility. We'll manage that facility. We'll sell that facility, and everybody involved will make money. You know, so that's kind of the way we approach our practice here.
Yeah. So let's you know, in our, because private equity, you know, there's a lot of confusion I sense in the marketplace sometimes. You know, we even when we called originally started calling our conference for early stage capital, the Southeast Private Equity Conference, and there was confusion in the marketplace for that as well on is it early stage or late stage or whatnot, right? And so we've been talking a little bit when it comes to sort of some of these examples of these businesses that you know, those guys that are sitting on, they got the cash on the sidelines, that are retired, they've got things paid for, they could go put, you know, $50,000 or $100,000, pool their funds, put some money in to help some of these local businesses. And that's really doing it as an individual investment on a private equity side, taking, you know, buying equity within a private company, which is, I guess, primarily regulated by the SEC from that standpoint. But then when it comes to investing in a private equity fund, you know, are there certain requirements or financial requirements that an individual must meet in order to invest in a private equity fund?
Yes, there are. In order to raise funds in today's world, you have to be at least the minimum requirement is a registered investment advisor. You can to raise money from the public, that is, and somebody you don't know. If it's your friends and family, you don't really have to be registered. They know you. They know whether you're legitimate or not. They know you. They've known you for decades. But if I'm raising money from a foundation or from trying to raise money from Joe Smith, my next-door neighbor, you know, I need to have some sort of registrations. I need to be a registered member of what they call FINRIA or FINRA, Financial Advisors, FINRA, Regulatory Authorities, I think is what it stands for. But you have to, in other words, you have to be registered. I took a Series 65 test. I actually used to own a broker dealership, so I was a Series 6 years ago, Series 7. So that was back in the 1980s. So, yeah, you're going to have the people that you're investing with in a fund-type situation are going to have securities people around them. They're going to need to be have some sort of credentials, either whether it's a Series 6 or 7 or 22 or the whole gambit of registrations, or just to be a registered investment advisor like our firm is. That's what our firm is, a registered investment advisor. And there's, you know, if you invest with a firm like that, they're required to give you certain documents called an ADV form, Form 2, Part 2. Form that outlines what types of investments they make, who they are, gives you backgrounds on them, their resumes, all the types of information that you would want to see in a registration. You're going to need to see that. A lot of times when people get burned in the private equity business, it's Don Smith down the street that's been selling deals forever, and he approached me the other day about putting $50,000 in this oil well, and you know, he's not registered in any way. He doesn't do any kind of reporting or anything to anybody about anything. He just sells deals and takes a little piece of money off the top. And those are the kind of deals that'll get you in trouble. So you got to watch out.
Right.
You got to watch out for that stuff. You know, you got to watch out for John Smith on the corner that's selling the latest private equity deal. You need somebody that's got a professional demeanor about them, and they know the private equity world, and they're registered, and they've taken the time to pay the fees, and they're members of professional associations. I'm a member of the CFA Institute, for instance. It's a very high level of highly ethical group of people that I live under their bylaws and their ethics, and you know, that's a very important thing for investors. You know, you need somebody that's going to tout that, yeah, these are the ethical laws that I live under, and if I don't live under them, you can prosecute me, you know, that kind of thing. So those are the types of things that you really need to do and really need to get to be secure in the private equity world.
So you got to make sure that you're really investing through somebody that's properly licensed because they're managing the fund, so therefore they're properly licensed or have the right kind of controls in place. And then, like, you know, can somebody that say they work with a Morgan Stanley or a Merrill Lynch or some investment, you know, house like that that brokers their stocks, can they go to those folks typically to find private equity funds as well, or usually these types of private equity funds really aren't even, they're not even on the radar of those types of brokerage houses?
Well, if you go to a Merrill Lynch or a Smith Barney or somebody like that that's still in business, you're going to, or an Edward Jones, the brokerage houses have different specialties, but like Edward Jones is not going to put you in a private equity deal. They're going to put you in a public mutual fund. That's all they do, stocks and mutual funds. But a Merrill Lynch type person or type group, they have what they call private client groups, that if you have $5 million in investable assets, they'll put you in the private client group, and yeah, then you'll have access to some of this stuff because you're an accredited investor and you meet all the requirements and that kind of thing. That's another thing we didn't talk about. To invest, mostly invest in private equity through funds or that type of thing, you have to be an accredited investor. If you go and buy an interest in a car dealership in your local town, you don't have to be an accredited investor. You just buy into a partnership or creating a partnership with the guy who owns the business. So that's a different type of a thing.
Okay, so it's different if you're participating with a bunch of other people, like in a private placement memorandum or in a private equity fund that has, you know, certain types of, contractual relationship between whatever. Then you have to be the accredited investor, but just buying a franchise or buying a part of a franchise, a part of a business, is really just a individual-to-individual contractual financial relationship.
If I want to go buy a McDonald's franchise, I don't have to be an accredited investor to do that. If I have the cash, I can go do it. You know, that's how my friend got in trouble with the sandwich shop. You know, he didn't have to be although he is an accredited investor, he didn't have to be. He could have gone to the Subway group or whoever it is, the sandwich shop group, and said, I want to buy a franchise, and they just sold him a franchise, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a different animal, but and you gotta kind of watch out for that. But there are lots of registered advisors around that have done the due diligence to be registered and that will put your money in a fund and use your money like they tell you they're going to use your money and not do the Madoff thing with it or not do the guy here in Texas that did the $7 billion thing. I forget what his name is now, but they're under indictment for a Ponzi scheme. They won't do the Ponzi scheme. They'll actually go out and buy the piece of real estate they're telling you they're going to buy, or they'll go out and buy a piece of an oil well or go out and buy, you know, build a hotel or whatever they're going to do with the money that they tell you they're going to do with the money, buy a piece of land or whatever. I forget what else we were talking about. Go ahead.
Well, that's, I was really just trying to find out, as people are listening in and they're trying to decide if this is a type of asset class they want to get involved in, what is it that they need to, you know, be prepared that they have to have in order to do that? And how do they go find the opportunities? We've talked about they can come to us and submit information on our contact page. They've got a question. You've given them your information as well, you know. And if they want to start exploring, my recommendation, if somebody wants to start exploring this as a new asset class for them, you know, same thing that I tell a lot of our angel investors when they get in. You don't necessarily want to jump on board and invest in the very first one. You want to sort of, you know, kind of like dating, right? You're not going to get married to the first person you meet. You want to meet a few people, and so you want to look at a few opportunities and kind of get a sense of the kinds of things that are out there over a 3-4 month period of time, do some due diligence on them, do some background checking on there, with the intention that within the next 3 to 4 months, you're going to know what your options are and be able to pick the best things to meet your personal requirements for making that investment on that private side, whether it's into an individual company or into a fund where you've got a pooled approach to how your money's been invested.
That's right, and the background check is probably the number one thing about that. If I go into a new venture somewhere, I'll go find an advisor. I'll go find somebody who's done it before. I've even used the Service Corps of Retired Executives called the SCORE team of the U.S. government. You know, they have some great resources, people that have, you know, been in the printing business for 50 years, and they know they've retired, and they're kind of going to the golf course every day now, but they've got 50 years of history behind them, you know, and you got to take their words with a grain of salt as well, but they may be negative about the printing business or something, but the publishing business or whatever you're thinking about doing, but go find somebody that's done it before. Go find somebody that's run a restaurant before and say, you know, this young kid has a new restaurant tech program, and we had a group out of Lubbock, Texas here not too long ago started a thing called Johnny Carino's, and it was a huge, you know, they spent hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars building these Johnny Carino's around, and they finally had to file bankruptcy because they were growing too fast, but that, you know, people that have worked in that environment that have built franchises like that can advise you, and they'll stop and talk to you if you just ask them. Most people will stop and talk to you if you just ask them. There's some that are so rude they won't, but most people will. So we had that situation. I had an acquaintance of mine that was opening a dessert store in a local mall here in West Texas, and I told him, I said, you know, so-and-so did this 10 years ago. Why don't you go talk to him? And he never did. And so-and-so would have told him, you know, there's no way you're ever going to meet your sales targets. The market won't buy it. We've been there. We've done that. We invested $200,000 and lost all our money. And you're about to do the same thing. Let's find something else to do with your $200,000. Let's not do that again, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a critical thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely. So as we get ready to wrap this up, let's give people a couple of places they can go get more information about your book, Winning with Private Equity. They can, the place to buy the book is http://www, winningwithprivateequity.us. Winningwithprivateequity.us, they can buy that. They can also go find Paul Thomas on Twitter to follow his posts and various things he's doing to talk about this topic. If you're at twitter.com, his user ID is P-A Thomas, P-A-T-H-O-M-A-S, 2009. And I just picked up following him, so his stuff, you're following me. I'm on twitter.com at Karen_Rands, and so if you're following me, then you'll end up picking up Paul's stuff as well, but you can follow Paul. And then he also is running a blog at winningwithprivateequity.wordpress.com, winningwithprivateequity.wordpress.com. And Paul, do you want to give them any other ways that they can reach out and connect up with you?
I'm on MySpace at Winning with Private Equity on MySpace. Let me see. That's about it, I guess. They can email me. They can find my email at Farpoint Advisors is the name of our company, Farpoint, FarpointAdvisors, farpointadvisors.com. And you can look at some of the programs we're doing now and working on. They can email me through there. They can also email me through oilstatestrading.com as well. If you Google me, you'll find me. I'm out there, and you can find me, and I'll be glad to help anybody that has any kind of questions. I'll be glad to consult with you or work with you to try to. One of the things I don't want you to do is lose your money. That's the last thing in the world
that
we want you to do is lose your money and invest it in a frivolous type program. We want you to invest it in programs that are solid and core and going to make you money, you know, day in and day out. So that's our problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've all lost enough money out there. We don't need to lose any more. It's all about creating wealth and helping turn this economy around by taking the capital that's on the sidelines and putting it to business as a compassionate capitalist. That's my mantra, being a compassionate capitalist. Put your money to work, creating jobs and bringing innovation to market, a new business to market, good, well-run businesses to market. And that's how we're going to turn this economy around. Not through a bailout, but through people that understand that they can create wealth by doing this as well, by doing these types of investments. So, you know, by making good, sound investments. And also create wealth for those entrepreneurs and the employees. And now employees have jobs and all kinds of good stuff on that regard. So I thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to share your insights and about your book. And you say you're going to have this as a series, so Do you already know what your next book is going to be entitled and be a topic of?
Oh, it's probably going to be Private Equity 2, Winning with Private Equity 2. It's going to be kind of simple. These are the book's only 80 pages long. It's a quick read. It was designed to buy at the airport and read on an airplane. So,
okay.
It's a quick read. It's got a lot of, in my mind, got a lot of good experiences in it. I use practical experiences to explain what the problem, what the pitfalls are, and where you can win with private equity, and what you need to do to win, and what you need to watch out for. So that's what we're trying to get people to read and make it easy for them. My eyes are not as good as they used to be, so the type's really big type, so you can read it real easy, you know. So I hope people will buy the book. We're real excited about it. We think it's got a lot to say to people that have money to invest and need to set themselves up and make themselves bulletproof as far as the economy goes.
Yeah.
That's our whole goal, is to be bulletproof and not let anybody take advantage of us and have income for life. So that's our whole goal.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay,
we have I thank you so much, and maybe I can end up contributing to one of your books in the future. I'm getting this compassionate capitalist thing out there. It got picked up by Performance Magazine. I'm on the cover of Performance Magazine with that topic, and so
wow.
I'm very excited about that. And I think you're on the right track. I love what you're doing, and want to support you in any way. I want to help you be successful in getting this message out in the marketplace.
Well, I want anybody out there that's listening that has a story to tell to email me and tell me, and if it tells a good story, I'll put it in my book and we'll use it. I appreciate that. Thank you for your time,
okay.
Karen. Thank you.
Sure thing. All right, so thank you very much, everybody, for listening in to the Compassionate Capitalist Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. And today we had Paul Thomas, as an author of Winning with Private Equity, talk through. We had a great discussion on all about what to look for, what to avoid when it comes to pursuing this as an asset class. Of course, we run the Network of Business Angels and Investors, which are those accredited investors that are investing in private equity opportunities. And we meet on a regular basis. Our next meeting in Atlanta is on August 10th, I think it is, the second Wednesday of August. And anybody that wants to join in on that, come and learn a little bit about getting involved in that particular type of private equity, we encourage you to go to the website, launchfn.com or nbani.net, and click on the information on investor events. So we'll fill out a contact form, contact us, and see what we can do to help you out in learning more about that. I also have a book on how to be an angel investor myself, and there's information about that on the website. And if you're a company looking for private equity, reach out to us and let us see how we might be able to help you. Thank you very much. It is August 12th, I've been told, by my soundboard. August 12th is the date. You think I'd know my own dates? August 12th is the date for the next Angel Investor Private Equity meeting in Atlanta. Working with companies that, whether that's the appropriate event or otherwise, and then also angel investors. We're about connecting them up and creating this wealth through compassionate capitalism. So thank you very much. Have a great day. Next week, we will be, before 4th of July, we'll be interviewing Jim DeBetta, talking about companies going to market, bringing their inventions to market, getting investors, and getting those products into the big box retail. It's going to be a great show, so tune in for that. Noontime, Blog Talk Radio. Thank you for tuning in for the Compassionate Capitalist Show. This is Karen Rand. Have an awesome weekend, and onward and upward. Go out there and be an economic architect. Thank you very much. Goodbye.